spirit, we will move into item number 11, which another scary thing. This is, God, it's enough to drive a man to drink by 5 o'clock, you know, all these things. Impacts of residues in salmon. So, yeah. Well, I won't get pregnant, maybe. That's good. If I eat the fish. So, Jim and Sandra, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Smith. My name is Jim West, and Sandy O'Neill and I will be here to talk to you about impacts of residues in salmon, which is kind of a fancy way of saying toxic contaminants
in salmon. I'm going to just spend a few minutes to introduce our toxics monitoring program, and Sandy is going to take over with the details of the science that I think you really want to hear about. Thanks to you all for having us here, and especially Commissioner Wecker for sending in the blue sheet to ask about this. It's really our pleasure to be here to talk to you. We've been around since about 1989. Conducting toxics monitoring in Puget Sound. We're sort of the go-to people when you ask questions about toxics in the ecosystem. We are here in the NRB in the FISH program, and we're called the Toxics and Biota Team. And if you look at our mission statement, that basically defines our simple goals: to evaluate the effects of toxic contaminants on marine anadromous species, to do three things. The first is to guide efforts towards protecting fish and shellfish health. We do that by going out into the ecosystem and finding where the contamination occurs, how bad it is, and then really the so what question is, how is it affecting the fish that are exposed to these contaminants? So that first thing is about fish health, and I think that's what you're asking about today. But we also spend time, we help to ensure seafood safety. We don't work on that directly, but we supply data to the Department of Health, who use that to assess the risk of consuming contaminated seafood when the contamination occurs. And we promote ecosystem recovery by working with agencies like the Puget Sound Partnership, Ecology, and EPA to help us. We have a concept of, say, what we call red flags. When we see an issue, we bring it forward. We try to help figure out where we should spend our precious resources in terms of recovering the sound. Next, please. We can't be everywhere all the time, and it's very expensive to monitor contaminants. So we use the concept of, sentinel species to help us understand contaminants in various habitats in Puget Sound. So we have these species that show us what's going on on the seafloor and the benthic habitats. We have species that tell us what's going on in pelagic habitats or open water. And we've got a species that helps us understand what's going on in the near shore. But again, what you're asking for today is salmon. And so Sandy is going to be talking about both adults and juveniles today. Our staff are seven strong. We're, again, as I said, we're here in the NRB. We've been around for a long time. I'm going to embarrass Sandy, who's going to take over the reins here in a second, by telling you that she just won the agency's 2015 Best Science Award, mainly for the work that she's going to be talking to you about today.
Thank you, Jim, and good afternoon, everybody. Understand contaminant residues in salmon, I think it's best that you understand the link between urbanization and contaminant inputs. The Puget Sound region has undergone tremendous amount of development in the last 100 years, and that has resulted in serious habitat, salmon habitat loss and modification. In particular, we think about altered water flows and temperature timing, things like that. The areas that are most affected, salmon are most affected by these urbanization impacts in the central and south parts of Puget Sound, because that's where all the people live. But it's also true that salmon in the central and south parts of Puget Sound are also most affected by contaminants. Wherever you have people, you have contaminants. And it's just, they just go together. It's just who we are. So these contaminants come from discharges from industrial development. They come from discharges from wastewater treatment plants, septic systems, runoff from the built environment, the roads we drive on, the houses we build. Also runoff from the agricultural properties that produce the food we eat. So there's just a lot. When you have people, you have contaminants. The reason we're here today, of course, is there was this great article that came out in the Seattle Times last February, I think it was, called Drugs Aplenty in Puget Sound, and it's Chinook salmon. And it was a study to look at one particular source of contaminants, things that you find in wastewater treatment plants. And the question that these scientists are interested, of course, is are these contaminants that are coming out of our wastewater treatment plants a concern for our fish? And as this cartoon demonstrates, the types of things we're worried about is, the Viagra that is getting out into the water or the Prozac going to do anything? So you've got these two fish deciding whether or not to go upriver, and one of them says the Viagra in the water wants to me to swim upriver, but the Prozac says I'm too tired. So that's sort of the big picture of where we're going with all this. So for the rest of the talk, I'd just like to give you a little bit of contaminant 101, a little bit to help you understand what's going on with contaminants, and then I'll just show you the highlights of what we're doing. And first I'll talk about some juvenile salmon studies. I'll tell you a little bit more about this study on chemicals and wastewater treatment. And then I'll also talk about WDFW's contaminant monitoring program for juvenile salmon. And then I'm going to go up the food web a little bit, and I'll talk a little bit about contaminants in adult salmon and what that means for salmon themselves, but also what it means for people and killer whales and other apex predators that eat them. So as you all know, salmon can be exposed to contaminants throughout their life cycle. They're anadromous, so that means you can get exposed if you're in a river, in the estuary, or the ocean, marine waters, including parts of Puget Sound. Of all the salmon species, those that are most at risk are Chinook salmon, and there's a number of reasons for that. First of all, as juveniles, Chinook salmon spend a lot of time in the lower parts of the river and also in the estuaries associated with those rivers where they're feeding and growing. And people like water. They like to build and work around water. And so all those contaminants that are in the water tend to flow downstream. Crap flows downstream, as you all know. And so these juveniles that are hanging out in these areas are most likely to get exposed. Adult Chinook salmon are also at greater risk than other species, and that's because as adults, the subadults and the adult Chinook salmon spending a lot more time feeding in coastal waters rather than the offshore North Pacific. Things like pink and chum and sockeye spend a lot of time in offshore waters feeding, whereas the Chinook are along the coast. And our salmon in particular spend time along the coast, but they also spend quite a bit of time in Puget Sound, and I'll come back to that later. They're also higher trophically, meaning they're higher on the food web, and so if they're exposed to anything, they can accumulate it over time. They live longer than some of the other species. The other thing you need to know about are that there are two major types of contaminants that salmon can be exposed to. And broadly speaking, they're those that accumulate and those that don't accumulate. And what we mean by that is if they don't accumulate, they're rapidly metabolized by the fish and they can't get passed up the food web. Whereas those that accumulate, they don't break down very quickly, so they stay in the salmon's body and they accumulate while they're feeding, and anything that eats that salmon also gets exposed. Now, for those chemicals, all chemicals, whether they accumulate or not, can affect the health of the animal. You can get exposed to something even though it doesn't accumulate, and it can cause a health impact. We tend to worry a lot more sometimes about those things that accumulate, because it means that not only can the salmon directly be impacted, but the things that eat the salmon can also get impacted. So juvenile salmon, when you're talking about juvenile, that means the things that eat them, the birds, the fish, the otters, things like that, can also get exposed to those contaminants. When you're talking about adults, we're talking about mostly people and things like southern resident killer whales, other apex predators. So again, what I'm here to talk about, now that we're done with the Contaminant 101, we will talk about this study that was done by NOAA and our colleagues at UW, and it was looking at chemicals of emerging concern in wastewater. They're called chemicals of emerging concern because there are chemicals that we don't know a lot about, but we think they could be a problem. So they're emerging as a potential risk. So they're, as opposed to those chemicals that we know, just like they're bad. Okay. So these are the contaminants of emerging concern. And this study was done in 2014, and they actually sampled wastewater effluent. They sampled some of the estuary water that was receiving that effluent. That would include Bremerton area, Sinclair Inlet, the Puyallup, and the Nisqually and South Sound. And they also measured some of these chemicals of emerging concern in fish. They looked at sculpins as well as salmon. The number of salmon samples was actually very, very small. There were only five samples that ended up at the lab. Now, some of these samples were a ground-up representative of 3 to 10 individuals, but really it's a small number of samples, so I just want to let you know. But the contaminant levels, though, not surprising, they were highest in salmon that were collected from the Puyallup. They were next highest in those that were collected from Sinclair Inlet. They were lowest in those from the Nisqually, but most interestingly, the authors thought that they wouldn't have any contaminants or very few that got picked up in the Nisqually. And so this is sort of just illustrates how pervasive these contaminants are throughout the whole of the central and southern regions of Puget Sound. So this is sort of what they detected, and I'm not going to go through all these lists of chemicals, but broadly speaking, they're called pharmaceuticals and personal care products. And by pharmaceuticals, that's all the drugs we take when we have a headache, your stomach is upset, my aunt has diabetes, you know, all those kinds of things. And so you name it, they found it. Antibiotics, antihistamines, antidepressants, so that joke about the Prozac, they actually found Prozac in the salmon. They found, the types of surfactants that you get in soaps, et cetera. So quite a few of them. I think there were over 40 different chemicals in total. So the big question, of course, is, so what does this mean? It's okay. If you have these chemicals and they're not high enough to do any harm, then what difference does it make? And we don't really know, actually, if this is a big issue or not. This is the first look at the dose, how much they're exposed to. And when you're talking about contaminants, it's all about the dose. Anything in a high enough dose can be a problem. But things that are really toxic can be a problem in really small doses. The degree of accumulation of these contaminants is not always known. We don't know how toxic a lot of these chemicals are. So NOAA is following up with a laboratory study. They've actually taken the fish back into the lab. They're exposing them to a lot of the contaminants that they measured, and they're going to come back and report what they think are some of the health impacts. So that's sort of the impacts just to juvenile salmon. So let's step back and talk about the food web. Not all of these contaminants are accumulated, but the subset that are will be for the, because they're juveniles, they'll be a concern for things like the birds that feed on them, otters, seals, things like that. These contaminants are less a concern for impacts to people and killer whales, mostly because we don't eat them. We're not eating these juvenile salmon. Not that they can't be in the water column and get accumulated, but there's no direct impact. Okay? Now I'd like to turn just briefly to talk about WDFW's contaminant monitoring program that we have. We first started this program in 2013. It was our pilot study. And unlike the previous study that was looking at contaminants of emerging concern, our question at the time was, are the juvenile Chinook salmon from Puget Sound exposed to known contaminants of concern, and are those levels at high enough to affect their health and survival? And we did this in part because we knew, based on laboratory exposure studies, that these chemicals were out there, and we knew what concentrations would be harmful to the fish. So the idea was to go out there, measure them, and see, and look at how much harm. We sampled five different river systems, starting from north to south, the Skagit, the Snohomish, the Duwamish, the Hylobos, and the Nisqually and South Sound. We measured fish in the lower part of the river as well as in the associated estuary nearshore waters where the fish feed for some time. And we actually looked at both accumulative and non-bioaccumulative contaminants. We sampled a total of 583 fish, which got combined into 88 different composite samples that were sent to the lab. And I'm not going to tell you what was detected. What I will do, though, is just tell you of all the contaminants that were detected, the so what question. Were they a problem or not? So what I'm going to show you on the next coming slides is the percent of the salmon that we sampled that had contaminant levels in them that were high enough to cause adverse effects. And these are, again, based on laboratory studies. If the salmon, expose them in the laboratory, they have this amount, they'll have this effect. And the types of effects that we're talking on based on the laboratory studies range all the way from, like, mortality to much more subtle things like changes in enzyme inductions and hormone alterations. Surprise, surprise, the Skagit and the Nisqually, which are the least developed areas, had none of the fish that we sampled for Chinook had were above these effects thresholds that we know are harmful. However, when we got to places like the Snohomish, about 36% of the fish were above effects threshold. In particular, we have an issue on the Snohomish with PBDEs, and in the lower river, as many as 100% of the fish had PBDE levels. These are flame retardants that are an issue, and we're following up on that this year, which I'll tell you about. And then the other two areas, of course, were the Duwamish River, the Green Duwamish that flows into Seattle, our most urbanized area. And 79% of the fish that we sampled there had some level of a contaminant that was associated with an adverse effect and potentially reducing their survival.
Just a quick question. Were the PCBs point sourced out?
None of these are point sources. So they can come in from multiple sources. We think of PCBs as a historic legacy contaminant because they were banned in the 70s. These are things that were in paints and transformers, lubricants. However, they are in the soils on a lot of developed property, and so when it rains, you get runoff from those developed properties. It ends there. Even buildings that have caulk with PCBs in them and paint, so there's an ongoing, every time there's a rain event, there's another flush of PCBs into Puget Sound.
Thank you.
Now what we're doing in 2016, we're expanding and building upon that pilot study that we had for juvenile Chinook salmon. In the first study, we only looked at five different river systems. Our goal this time is to expand our coverage and look at all the ESA populations within the Puget Sound Evolutionary Significant Unit, which is a pretty tall order. And we couldn't do it on our own. We've had a series of workshops, and we have all the tribes that are working within the Puget Sound region, as well as NOAA, Tulalip, Snohomish County, King County, you name it. Everybody is out there helping us to collect these salmon because everybody wants to know, okay, are my salmon contaminated too? We've expanded the number of chemicals we're looking at. We did known contaminants before. This time we're going to do some of those chemicals of emerging concern that I talked about in the previous study. And then we're also going to try and model what proportion of the contaminants, you know, are affecting the total population. So I told you in the last study that 79% of those fish from the Duwamish were contaminated. But, of course, it's the Skagit population that contributes most to the overall productivity of Puget Sound. So we're going to model, you know, what these contaminants, how they're affecting the whole of the Puget Sound population. At least we hope to. So stay tuned for that, and we can come back and tell you about that if you'd like at some point. So now what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about what's happening in adult salmon. And in particular, I'm going to talk about some of these bioaccumulative contaminants. And again, Chinook salmon is what we're going to talk about. And I've just told you about all these things that happen to juvenile salmon, but when you're talking about accumulative contaminants. When these fish leave Puget Sound and they, you know, they're going leaving the river and they're going into Puget Sound, they're putting on most of their growth while they're feeding either in Puget Sound in the ocean. And so for adult salmon that are coming back, most of their contaminants weren't accumulated in that little river that they left. Most of them were accumulated on wherever they fed, on their way out of Puget Sound, while they were swimming around in Puget Sound, or out in the open ocean. So if you spend all your time out in the open ocean, you put on more clean tissue than the contaminants that were in your body on the way out. So we, when we started doing this, we did not think that Puget Sound salmon would be very much different than any other Chinook salmon up and down the coast. And we were dead wrong. So we went, and this is some old data, which we've presented actually to one of the previous commissions. And when we looked at contaminant levels in Chinook salmon up and down the coast, these were based on some published reports, we found out that our salmon are 3 to 5 times more contaminated than other West Coast populations with PCBs. These are, again, fillet studies, fillets that we sampled. It was back in 1992 to 1998. Not only were they more contaminated, but based on these laboratory control studies, we would think that about 22% of the salmon had exceeded some adverse effects threshold. So we actually repeated this sampling design again, this time with, this is whole body salmon. I'm sorry, my labeling didn't come through, but this is whole body salmon. And then these were sampled in about 2002 to 2004. This was part of a killer whale prey study. That's why we did whole body salmon. But again, the story is the same. Puget Sound is a little different. And by now, you're asking yourself, you just told me they get all these contaminants in the ocean, so why is Puget Sound different? It turns out that the real problem for Puget Sound salmon, and it's a natural problem, is that the resident salmon, those that reside in Puget Sound, actually pick up a lot of contaminants. So we have, and here this bar shows you that the contaminant levels in the resident Chinook that we get are, you know, at least twice as high as what you get in the average population as a whole. And so what's happening is those fish that are residing in Puget Sound and eating are getting exposed to contaminated herring, et cetera, and they're accumulating these contaminants. And when you go out and sample a salmon in the river, you, and it's going back to spawn, you don't know if it was a resident or not a resident. Turns out that about a third of Puget Sound Chinook salmon have some degree of residency in Puget Sound. It's just a natural phenomenon. They do it. Lots of salmon are resident. So if you're a resident salmon off the Queen Charlotte Islands, it doesn't really matter because you don't live in a contaminated environment. But if you're resident in Puget Sound, you get exposed to a lot more things. So really, it's the Puget Sound itself that makes us, and the residency of Puget Sound, that's an issue. So what does this mean for people? The Department of Health back in 2006 put out a report recommending restricting intake of Puget Sound Chinook salmon to 4 meals a month. Unrestricted intake would be about 16 meals a month. So that if you were fishing in Alaska, they'd say, oh, eat up to 16 meals a month. They also, though, put out a special recommendation that if you were in a sports fishery and you're focused on that winter blackmouth fishery, those resident fish, that don't eat more than 2 of those a month, because we know you're selecting a subset of the population of Chinook salmon that's more likely to be contaminated. We are actually right now out, or this year we have been out sampling more resident Chinook salmon from different places throughout the Sound. When this advice first came out, we only had residents from the central part of the Sound. And we now know that from other studies, tracking studies with salmon, that these salmon, when they're resident, they tend to be resident in the part of, in one part of the Sound. So if you're a resident in the central Sound, you might get exposed to contaminants. But some of these fish are resident in the north part of the Sound near the San Juans. And so we're now sampling different parts, resident salmon in different parts of the Sound, hoping that the Department of Health will be able to improve the advice and be less restrictive and say, only reduce your intake of, you know, resident Chinook salmon in certain parts of the Sound. So again, that's going to happen soon. So the last thing I just want to tell you about is that, of course, these contaminants, again, as I said, like the PCBs can magnify up the food web. And we do know that our resident Chinook salmon, our southern resident Chinook salmon, are very, very contaminated, more contaminated than northern residents. The J-pod that spends more time feeding in Puget Sound than the K&L pod are also more contaminated, so it's really a Puget Sound issue. And there have been lots of papers published about this, but there's one paper in particular where they modeled the amount of contaminants in Puget Sound salmon and determined that the levels in Puget Sound salmon are high enough to impair the health of the whales. It's hard to take the whale to the doctor, so that's how they look at it, modeling exercises. So with that, I'd like to recap by just pointing out that juvenile salmon, especially Chinook, migrating through our urban systems are exposed to contaminants at levels high enough to reduce their survival. There are no direct impacts to people and killer whales from those eating, you know, juveniles. We don't eat them. Adult salmon do have high levels of PCBs and other contaminants, and again, it's associated with their residency in Puget Sound. The Department of Health is going to be reviewing our contaminant advice for Chinook salmon as soon as we get our samples to the end of the year. And the contaminants that are accumulated in the Chinook salmon are a concern for people, obviously, as well as apex predators. And finally, I didn't actually have time to show you any data, but I didn't want to leave you with the impression that there weren't any non-bioaccumulative or non-accumulative contaminants. There are, there's quite a few studies that have been done by our colleagues at NOAA documenting that coho salmon are exposed to these non-accumulative contaminants in small urban streams, and they can cause pre-spawn mortality. So again, it's not a health risk because they don't accumulate in bodies, so it's not a health risk for whales and killer whales, but it does affect the health of the salmon. And with that, take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. It's another one of these. Reality is scary sometimes. And congratulations on your research award.
That's very nice.
That's outstanding. We're very proud of you.
Thank you.
So, questions? Yes.
I'd just like to get a copy of your paper.
Sure. There are several papers, and we can send copies. And Tammy, you'll make a note and remind us, and we can give you a copy of our report from our 2013 study, and we can give you some others that we've published as well.
Yeah, that's good.
I also noticed, although you didn't mention it as you were presenting, Department of Health suggests cutting away the fat in salmon.
They do.
Because concentrates in the contaminants.
They do. It tends to, a lot of these contaminants are what we call lipophilic. They just like the fat, and so that's where they tend to go. And so if you cook the salmon and let the fat drip away, that's good. If you don't eat the skin, that's good. A lot of the contaminants are in the fat. So that's some of their advice as well. Our contaminants, or our analysis is done on fillets with the skin off and not cooked. So we do it on raw.
I feel good. I just got all my fish up in the Queen Charlotte's Levee.
There you go. But, you know, I did show a picture of my brother feeding on this is my brother here. He grew up on the East Coast of Canada, and he has this 36-pound Chinook, and we ate it, and it was delicious. I got to tell you that.
Also, I wanted to find out, who's doing your dose response curves?
So those have been, a number of studies have been done, but Jim Metter is currently doing the one on these chemicals of emerging concern.
And who's he with?
He's with NOAA. NOAA has done most of the work. They have been absolute leaders in this. So Mary Arcouche down at their Newport lab has looked at these flame retardants. Jim has also looked at things like these PCB effects. Mary and Jim have looked at pHs, the oil-related products. So they are the leaders in sort of the health effects. So we do the exposure, they do the effects, so we make a great team.
Great. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
On the Spokane River, we're currently working on a TMDL for studies. And there are point sources that have been identified. So there are permits obviously involved. Non-point sources are a concern and harder, of course, to deal with. Are there TMDLs for some of these rivers that have been developed? And there must be point sources. I mean, sewage treatment is a point source of PCBs. as well as still industrial sources, even though they've been banned. That's what we've learned on the Spokane.
There are TMDLs for a lot of rivers, and so like the Duwamish in particular is a Superfund site, and so there's a tremendous amount of effort to clean up the upland lands that drain into the Duwamish. So the Lower Duwamish Work Group is working on that. So Boeing, City of Seattle, Port of Seattle, there's all of that sort of work that takes place. There is work underway to clean up the contaminated sediments in and around Puget Sound. The harder part is how do you clean up the open waters of Puget Sound? Because once those bioaccumulative things get into the food web, you sort of can't take them out. So that is just, we just have to learn by our mistakes and don't repeat them. So the biggest thing that we can do is to turn off the tap to begin with. So we have bans for PBDEs in Washington State now. The other thing we can do is just sort of clean chemistry and biofiltration systems. There's a lot of work looking at filtering stormwater to remove these contaminants before they get into Puget Sound, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I have one other quick question. What's vitellogenin?
Vitellogenin is a protein that helps eggs develop in fish. And so we've actually published studies with our friends at NOAA in male bottom fish that have high levels of vitellogenin. If you're a male fish, you shouldn't really have high levels of vitellogenin to help your eggs develop. It's just not right. And so some of these studies have measured when you expose salmon to contaminants, they will actually get vitellogenin production even in juvenile fish that shouldn't be producing eggs or in males.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I was just curious though. We collected data long enough to have an idea if things are getting worse, getting better, staying the same.
Jim, why don't you take that one? It's good.
Thanks, Director Unsworth. We're just about ready to publish a paper that's recapping our data going back to the late 1980s for English sole, which is our bottom fish, and herring. You know, we don't monitor adult salmon every year, but we do so with herring or every other year. Herring is sort of a mid-level predator in the pelagic zone. So we've got a bottom fish and a midwater fish. And what we're seeing for PCBs, the ones that Sandy was just talking about in our herring, is a flat line for the last 16 years. So the tap for PCBs has not been shut off. And, and other places in the world have seen the same thing. For English sole, it's variable depending on whether they're in some urban areas are showing increases and so on. But for salmon, their prey, herring, is pretty flat.
Adult salmon.
Yeah, for adult salmon. For other chemicals, like Sandy mentioned, the PBD, the flame retardants, we've tried to shut the tap off on those, and we think we're doing a good job on it because those levels are declining fairly rapidly in herring.
Lyndall Johnson is another researcher at the NOAA lab, and we are co-authoring a paper with her because NOAA actually started doing all this contaminant monitoring in juvenile salmonid, but they didn't do broad, systematic studies. They would do a little sampling here and a little sampling there. But so Lyndall has taken the data that we collected in 2013, and she's comparing it against some very limited data sets at a few locations. And she is seeing declines in some chemicals in juvenile salmon, things like DDTs, chlorinated pesticides, some of the petroleum-related products like the pHs, the exhaust that comes out of your car. The declines, as Jim said, in PCBs are not as obvious. And that's over a 25-year period. A little bit, but not great.
Has the EPA done the monitoring on brownfields or Superfund to reinforce what you're saying on remediation? I mean,
yeah, so we have presented this work to EPA Region 10. We've presented it to, in particular, to the Lower Duwamish Work Group. We've presented it to the Ryan 9 area that in the Duwamish, you know, that manages salmon. So everybody's aware, and I think there's a lot that's being done. The funding streams, you know, are different than the habitat, but I think it's just a slow process.
That is.
Yes.
I think
Dr. Mankin.
I know that farm salmon are fed an artificial diet, but there is a salmon farm very near Sinclair Inlet. Have you had an opportunity or are interested in looking at PCBs in farm salmon? And likewise, in the captive brood stocks that are maintained at the Manchester Laboratory from various parts of Puget Sound, but are grown on salt water?
Yeah, I haven't looked at those. There are some published papers that have looked at contaminants in farm salmon. And as Dr. Mankin said, farm salmon are fed pellets, food, which is basically just ground-up fish. It's usually fish from marine environments. So if those fish that go into the pellets are from a contaminated area, you're just, you know, giving them more PCBs. So historically, that was a really big problem. In recent years, there's been a really big effort to reduce the contaminants in farm salmon. In particular, they're reducing the fat content, and so that reduces the amount of contaminants that are accumulated. So I haven't looked at those populations locally, but I would guess that they might have a slightly higher level, but probably not as great as just feeding in Puget Sound. I mean,
I heard rumors a few years ago also that they were finding higher than normal PCBs in Copper River Chinook. Is that true?
There's one study. It was Copper River sockeye, not Chinook.
Ah, okay.
It's Copper River sockeye. And it sticks out like a sore thumb when you look at all the contaminant levels up and down the coast. But that particular study did not use an analytical technique that most of the other studies have used. So I'm not sure if it was an analytical difference, the instrumentation and the approach, but none of the other studies that I've looked at for contaminants in Alaska in particular have found high levels of contaminants. You always find higher levels, even in Alaska, you'll find higher levels of contaminants in Chinook than sockeye and, you know, chum, pink, but not That was an unusual study.
Yeah.
Is that atmospheric deposition?
Don't know.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, probably. But I'm guessing the Copper River Chinook salmon would have higher levels.
Little lipids.
Just because they're fattier. So the very few PCBs that are out in the North Pacific are being scavenged better by them than animals that have lower lipids. But as Sandy said, the total concentration is pretty low.
Yeah. And even when you correct for the lipids, it was still a little high. And again, it could be the methods.
Okay. Again, thank you. Very, very informative. And
thank you. Bye-bye.